FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. On August 5th, 1998, in the small Tennessee town of Cookeville, an older couple known locally for owning and financing properties were executed in their home. Victor and Alla Kalentikow were asleep in their beds when someone entered the house, shot both of them to death, and then burned their house to the ground. The case is full of mystery. Victor had a top-secret job working for the government, and the couple was in the process of foreclosing on several properties. All of this should have led to a thorough investigation. There were many, many people with obvious motives. But instead of investigating the case, local law enforcement immediately set their sights on a man named Greg Lance. Greg was tried and convicted for the double homicide in 1999 and has been fighting to clear his name ever since. His efforts seemed to be in vain, until today's guest got involved. Rabia Chowdhury was the reason the Serial podcast ever existed. She's the one who pitched Adnan's case to Sarah Koenig. She has spent most of her adult life working to try to free her family friend Adnan Syed from prison. And over the last 5 years, she has continued on to fight for many more who have been wrongfully imprisoned. Rabia hosts the Undisclosed podcast, along with two other lawyers, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Through their work, they have been a part of an astounding 9 exonerations. Rabia is hoping to add this case to the list. This is Season 9, Episode 4, The Case of Greg Lance.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rabia, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today and telling us a little bit about the Greg Lance case.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bob. I'm excited to talk to you. You know, I love getting a chance to connect with you any time I get.
I know. We should start recording the half-hour conversations we have every time before we record.
I know. It's the pre-conversation and the post-conversation.
Right. Well, Rabia, before we get into the Greg Lance case, which was one of the subjects of the Undisclosed podcast, I want to talk a little bit about, for my listeners, about the Undisclosed podcast. And if you give us a little bit about your background, how you got into podcasts in general, and then how the Undisclosed podcast came to be.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I am an attorney and I practiced immigration, civil rights and during my professional career. But I have been, since 1999, working on a case, the Adnan Syed case, which was the subject of Serial, for all these years, trying to basically help exonerate him because I believed he was free. And sometimes when I think it was 2013, we had kind of hit this wall in the appellate process. And I was like, I can't do it anymore. It's not working. And I reached out to the This American Life team that turned into Serial. As everybody knows, it exploded. But what was happening when Serial ended, when Serial was ongoing, I was blogging about it. A bunch of other people were blogging about the case. Other lawyers were. But when it ended, a lot of people were left kind of unsatisfied. And a friend of mine said, listen, nobody's reading your blogs. You should take all that material you've written and do your own podcast because people want to know more about the case. And there isn't a lot of resolution with Serial. I mean, it was a great story, but there wasn't a lot. There was a lot of stuff that they missed, like from a legal perspective, So I teamed up with two other lawyers who I didn't know, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. And we're like, all right, you know what? All three of us were blogging about the case. And so let's just do this. We're just going to cover Adnan's case and that's it. So I think we ended up doing like 30 episodes on Adnan's case because we go, like your show, into a lot of detail and answering so many questions that Serial left and also others that Serial never touched. But by the time we were done, we had requests from other defendants and lawyers and instance projects from across the country say, hey, can you take a look at this case too, by the way? And so it's just, that's how it got started. And we have an incredible audience that loves to really dive deep into these cases. So we've been on the air for about 5.5 years. We've covered 22 cases. We work with the defendants and their lawyers. We've helped in 9 exonerations so far. And it's just been incredibly fulfilling work, even though it's hard work. You know how it is, Bob. It's very frustrating, emotional, tough work.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, you're always under the gun, and somehow you and Susan and Colin made it work. I mean, how did you pick, of all the bloggers and people out there, how did you pick Susan and Colin? Because the three of you make up such an amazing team, because you all have your different strong suits. How did you land on Susan and Colin?
Yeah, I bring like the emotional energy, the weepy factor, and the right. anger, the rage. I found Susan and Colin's blogs were both posted on Reddit. And when I read, I actually remember the day that I read Susan's blog that was about Jay's statements as she compared it to the cell phone evidence. And I was like, and it was like a 40-page long blog. It was ridiculous. And I was like, who is this woman? Like, who is this woman? Because she was able to figure out why Jay kept changing his statements, and Jay Wilds was the main witness in the case. And even Sarah Koenig in Serial was like, I don't know why Jay's making this. Nobody could figure it out. Why his statements kept changing, and Susan Simpson figured it out. And I'm like, this person. And even before we had even decided to work together, I was like, can I just give you the rest of the documents that are not public, just to see what else you can pull out of them? And Colin was blogging as well. And he one day blogged about the lividity. And again, I was like, first of all, it's a professor, you know, he's a law school dean and professor. So he's like very academic, very intellectual. And Susan's Sherlock Holmes. So it's like, I just got lucky. Adnan got lucky. It's an amazing team. And I'm the lightweight in it, but you know, I get dragged along with them. Those two are like the superstars.
Well, and I love what you guys have done. Can you talk a little bit about, you've adapted your process and the result has been incredible. I mean, the work obviously speaks for itself, 9 exonerations, you know, and you've covered the 22 cases. But, you know, with Adnan, it was very, very long form, you know, you said 30 episodes, goes on for a long time. And you guys have shifted that to where now you do like some mini series, kind of mini season.
Yeah, because there's no way you can do that year after year after year, especially because the three of us, I'm now kind of full time doing this work. But Susan and Colin, I think they still have other jobs. And so up until 2 years ago, when I had another child, I also was working another full-time job. So the three of us with full-time jobs could not be full-time also investigating other cases. So what it's kind of transformed into is every year Undisclosed has one long season, which will be the long in-depth case. It'll be like maybe 12 main episodes, 12 addendum episodes, and then additional whatever episodes are needed, like when new stuff comes out. And Susan and I kind of take turns taking leads on those. And then but before and after that long season, Colin will do miniseries. Like, so he'll do between like a 4-episode to an 8-episode, more of a storytelling type of story on smaller stories, stories where we don't really have the time to investigate, and maybe doesn't even need investigation, but it needs like a public push, like a petition, like something like that. Right. So, but calling awareness to these cases. So Colin will do 3 or 4 of those a year. Then Susan and I are responsible for our own cases. We do the investigation, we do the research, we do the scripting, and that helps relieve the burden. So the year that Susan is doing that, I don't have to do that, but I'm already preparing for my next year's case type of thing, and on and off.
It's a great process. And one thing that I've noticed as you've done that process, as well as the people you've brought onto your team, is that your production quality is incredible. And I remember back to the first episode of Serial Dynasty.
Don't remember.
And I remember the first episode of Undisclosed, and I remember thinking, I can do that good at least when I heard.
If they can do that, I can do that. Oh, Bob. Right. It was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. The whole world was watching. I mean, every outlet, every newspaper outlet had announced that Serial Part 2, the follow-up to Serial, is going to come. And it was like Rolling Stone, every major outlet. And I was like, shit. And it was awful. I edited that. I don't know how to edit. I did it in GarageBand, which I learned over a weekend. It was terrible. But, you know, you live and you learn. And I think that's the great thing about this medium, is that we are able to live and learn through it. But also, we have such incredible listeners, Bob. I mean, like our listener base, our audiences are so loyal. They allow us to F up. They allow us to screw up and get up and fix it. And I appreciate that so much.
Yeah. And that's one nice thing about, and I think we have a lot of crossover between your audience and my audience, but especially with our process, because we, as I was telling you before we started rolling, you know, we have our rat race here where we, or rat wheel, where we, every Monday it's like, what's the new subject? Start researching, start reading, start writing, and then record and edit, and then breathe for 2 days on the weekend, then start all over again every week. And that process definitely results in a lot of mistakes, and our audience is very forgiving of that too.
Yeah. Yeah. You get stuff wrong. You get facts wrong sometimes. You got to make corrections. That's okay. I mean, we're all, you know, it's just, that's life.
You know, the worst thing for me lately is since COVID, you know, Mike actually lives like 35, 40 minutes away from me. And so he started working remotely most of the time. He's only here 1 or 2 days a week, sometimes 3. And I found without him here to babysit me, I screw up way more, because usually he's sitting in the booth with me when I have my script on my teleprompter. And when I flub something, he's like, nope, 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 you screwed that up.
Yeah.
But now instead I get a text like, can you go back in the booth and re-record this line? Because you said your name instead of someone else's name.
It can be hard to be diligent when you're just like alone in a room by yourself. I mean, most of the time I'm like, I really should like go through the script or something. And I'm like, well, let's see what's happening on Twitter instead. It's hard.
Right. Yeah, I do the same thing. You know, speaking of Twitter, you know, I still, well, and it's a fact, I credit you to me being able to change careers and get out of the fire service, because you were the first person. Of course, we didn't know each other. We'd never met. But when I made the Serial Dynasty, you started retweeting some of my stuff and tweeting back. And that, you know, everybody was so hungry for serial content back then, and you know, stuff about Adnan's case, that it drove enough people to kind of get me launched when I started doing the podcast. And it's funny, we were talking about the audio production, because I still remember like the first tweet you sent, you retweeted it, and I think you tagged Colin and Susan in it and said, well, it sounds better than our first episode. This guy's all right.
Yeah. Listen, it's been rough. It's been, and you know, what's also hard is when you have, because that first series, we had no system set up. It wasn't like, okay, I'll do the scripting, you do the, it was like, it was ad hoc. And the three of us would all be in the scripts together. That's three different voices. You know, my series is going to sound different than Susan's. And it's going to, I can tell when I read a script who wrote it. Like I can, I don't know if our audience can, but we have different voices and we write differently and think of the stories differently. And it was like just like the three of us trying to meld our brains together. It was ugly. But listen, you credit nobody but yourself, because I was really astonished that somebody like you, who has a full-time job, has no reason to give so much time, energy, effort to the case of this young man who he doesn't know at all, but is doing it out of a sense of justice. And I was just bowled over in awe of you. And I still am.
Well, I appreciate it. And I am definitely in awe of you guys. And for part of that reason is due to your coverage of the Greg Lance case, which is what I want to dig into now.
Yeah.
Now, this case I was a little more familiar with than some of the others. You know, I don't have time to listen to every episode of every podcast out there, but I listened to a lot of Undisclosed, but I actually got to participate a little bit in the Greg Lance case.
Yeah, you were my first guest on the first addendum for that series.
Right. And it was, and the case is absolutely fascinating. So can you kind of break down the basics of the case?
Yeah. The very basics of the case is August 5th, 1998, in this very rural area, Cook County, Tennessee, there was a couple that was executed basically in their sleep. They were an older couple in their 60s, a Russian-Ukrainian couple, very different from the rest of the community around them, Victor and Al Klesnikow. And Victor had been, the reason they were out there was he was a nuclear scientist, and he'd been working on, I guess, nuclear, nobody exactly knows what, but nuclear stuff out in that region. And he kind of became a slumlord. He just started, like, I don't know, buying up all these really broken down properties and selling them to people and then evicting them. He didn't have a great reputation. Anyhow, he was murdered this night. It was like in the middle of the night, and then his house was set on fire. Everything was set on fire. And by the time the authorities got there, I think the house had already, it was like a blaze, and they couldn't recover a whole lot. And this is like around 3 a.m. By like 7 a.m., they had their suspect, and that suspect was Greg Lance, who happened to be one of the people who had bought a property from Victor and Alla and who they were now trying to foreclose on. So the theory was they're trying to foreclose on him, so he must have done it, except that at that time, they were also foreclosing on like a dozen other people,
right,
including people who lived right across the street from them, the Horns, a family of very, very dangerous people with, like, I can't even tell you how many murder stories are and murder convictions are related to that family. So, but nobody ever looked at the Horns. And so that's kind of the long short of it. Greg was arrested for the murder the following spring, and he has always maintained his innocence. He had an alibi that night. He was seen on camera at a video store later that night. He went home where he was seen by his wife and a friend. I mean, it's almost impossible for him to have time warped himself to commit all that murder, leave no forensic evidence behind, get back in bed. And he absolutely didn't do it. And so all these years later, he's been in prison for over, 20 years now.
Now, the victims, they were foreclosing on 12, a dozen or so people. Mm-hmm. They had some shady practices. If I understood it correctly, they would sell people a property on land contract. And then, so they would give them a down payment and give them payments. And then look for a reason to then foreclose on them where they would get their property back and get to keep the money.
Right. They would do things like, say, you didn't pay the property tax, and the property tax maybe has been due or not been due. And, but Greg was smart. Greg knew how they operated. And from the beginning, he already had an attorney. He was a really smart, savvy guy. He was college educated. He wasn't like a lot of the other people that they were able to take advantage of. And most people, when they got the eviction notice of foreclosure, they would just kind of wrap up and leave. But he was fighting it. He had a bankruptcy lawyer. I mean, he had his ducks in a row, and he was absolutely going to keep that property. It was a whole trailer park. And so what Victor's allegation, as somebody who basically holds the note on the mortgage on that, was that part of the mortgage agreement included that Greg would make certain improvements on the property, and that he didn't. And Greg was, they were still going through the process, and Greg was going to show that he had made these improvements. And so it was an excuse to get the property back, having already gotten a big fat down payment and gotten payments like for a couple of years, right? And now Greg made improvements, the property's worth more, and they wanted it back. And they did it over and over again.
Well, and the state made it seem like this was a simple case, motivated by money. They did him wrong. They were trying to take his property, so he killed him. But it gets far more complicated because of Victor's career in his past. I mean, we look at him as this like slumlord, but as you said, he was a nuclear scientist. And what was his background before moving to Tennessee to do whatever secret nuclear work he was doing?
Yeah, so his wife and him, they were from the Ukraine. Russia at the time as part of the Soviet Union at the time. They moved to the United States. He worked in Canada for a while. He was in California then. He worked for the U.S. government under a super secret clearance. And nobody really knew. They were just called the foreigners out in Tennessee. And nobody really knew exactly what they were doing out there. And he would travel a lot to New York. So there were rumors that he was involved in some kind of Russian mafia thing. Maybe it was a Russian mafia hit, that maybe the government was trying to keep him silent because he knew nuclear secrets. I mean, there were all kinds of conspiracy theories. At the end of the day, it was nothing so glamorous, though. I mean, we pretty much know what happened to him and who killed him. But that caused a lot of kind of intrigue. They were certainly a really odd couple out in that area. But the thing is, that nobody knew them. Nobody really knew their family and the kid. They had kids, but none of the kids lived in the area. So they were kind of out there by themselves.
Yeah. And when you look at the crime scene, which I was doing when I was on your addendum, it looks very much like an assassination. The fact that it looks, that somebody came in and shot them both and then burned the house down to burn evidence. It looked like a very professional hit almost.
Right. So people thought, okay, maybe it was a hit because they were killed in their bedroom. Alla was still in bed. She was in bed on her back, had been shot three times, once or twice through the eyes. So clearly she never even got up. Victor, it looked like, was trying to get out of bed. So I'm guessing he was the second victim. He probably heard the gunshot and rolled out of bed. But he was shot almost immediately, like right by the bed as well, holding onto a bedpost. And then the arson investigators uncovered like this whole trail of gasoline that went through the house. And the house was set on fire and a lot of it was burned to bits. And so the question is, I mean, why would somebody do that if it was just going to be a hit? But we've also figured out why that happened too, why it was actually burned to the ground. But the thing is, this happened at night. And so the question is, how could somebody, like we were initially like, how could somebody have seen how could they even have aimed in the dark, right? Until the murder weapon was found and it was a gun, a Tech 9 that had a flashlight taped to it. And that's how, the murderers killed them in the dark. I think they just crept in while they were sleeping, pointed a flashlight, shot her between the eyes and got Victor immediately as well.
Right. And also, I think the gun itself is interesting because that's not a gun that just something someone has laying around the house for self-defense. I mean, a Tech Nine is essentially what, you know, people in our generation would call an Uzi.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a common gun.
It's not a hunting gun.
Right. So I want to get into where your investigation led and who we think did this. But before we do that, so we know why Greg was a suspect. Because he was one of the people being foreclosed on. But why did they single him out as opposed to the other people? And then how did they build a case that landed him in prison?
Well, as far as we know, they literally didn't look at anybody else. They just didn't investigate. And this is almost exactly what happened in the Nance case, where, and this is so common, like cops will get like tunnel vision investigators and they won't look outside of that tunnel because they've got somebody in their sights and that's it. And so there's no evidence in the entire investigative file that they even considered another suspect at all. And so the next day, what happened was the next morning, they showed up at Greg's home and they were with him all day. And then they booked him and took, and all day, they're like, we know you did it. Just tell us how you did it. We know you weren't happy. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And they just tried to wear him down. And he's like, he wouldn't give in. And when they showed up, they're like, you know, can we, you know, look at your stuff. And he's like, yeah, sure. So he didn't object to, and he, like I said, he was a smart guy. He knew, you know, how the law worked, but he was like, go ahead, take my shoes. He let them shave his arms and legs and take hair. He let them collect his guns. He's like, take anything you want. I have nothing to hide. Like, I have nothing to do with this. And a couple of the reasons they were focused on him was, what happened was, like, in the hours after the murder, the very first person they spoke to was Victor's sister. She was the only relative. She was much older. She was, like, really elderly, who lived in the area. And the only name she was able to provide was, she's like, I think it might have been this guy. They have a court case with him that has a hearing date this week. So they had a hearing date that week on Greg's case. And his sister said it. And I think they just went with it. And that was it. And the way they were able to convict him, they could not connect him to the murder weapon. They could not connect. The lab said that one hair from his hand was singed. He'd been wearing shorts that night. It was on video at this convenience store that night. Nothing else. Like, there was, I remember asking you, could somebody have set a fire that huge? It was a big blazing fire. Get away with it without any other evidence, like on their shoes, like smoke, gasoline. They found nothing. So, the way they were able to do it was they did what police often do when they cannot connect a person to a crime is that they look for witnesses that they can coerce, manipulate, and pressure into giving statements. So they were able to do that with a few of the people who worked for Greg. And Greg was in the construction business and he hired a lot of people who, you know, who are like people like who had addiction problems and who were on parole. He was really nice. He would let them stay in his home. And eventually they all kind of just turned against him, but nobody testified that he committed the crime or they had any evidence, but they testified to things like he was really angry at them. He had been asking about how to get a gun. And he had because he was in the National Guard and also he was applying to be a police officer in a local police station. And also everybody had guns out there. So it was just that kind of insinuation that in front of a jury did it. And then his alibi defense was not presented. And there was a reason for that. It's because he was with another woman that night and he had a girlfriend, fiance at the time. And so that wouldn't have looked good for him either way.
Mm-hmm. But so the other woman would provide an alibi for him. They just didn't want to tarnish his character in front of the jury.
Well, there were two things that happened and this was like really complicated. And what happened was they did not talk to her until about a year. And he had only had like a one, like it was, he knew her from the National Guard, but they had only been together once that night. And they found evidence. They found the booking for the hotel. They found the evidence that he had paid for the room. So they had been together. They had met up that evening around 7 or 8. Then they went to a hotel. And then Greg said he left the hotel room around 12:30, stopped at a convenience store around 1 a.m., which is where he's seen on camera. And then he came home. But what happened was when his lawyers went to speak to that woman, which is almost a year after this whole thing took place, she said to them, oh, he was with me all night. He didn't leave until like maybe 3 or 4 a.m. And Greg said, that's not true. I know I left at 12:30. And so there was this like situation where she's probably misremembering because it's been a while. And also they've been drinking that night. But they can't put her on the stand and say that when they have this videotape. I mean, like, they couldn't reconcile these statements. And Greg was like, I that's just not true. What she's saying is not accurate. So I don't know what to do with that. So they just decided to completely scrap her.
Yeah, that's a tough situation. So the entire case of him was just completely circumstantial. Basically, sounds like they were just trying to prove motive. Was there any witnesses that they actually saw him there?
No, absolutely not. Zero. Nothing. 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 Not only did there's no witness they saw him there. There's no the only they connected him. Okay, there was one piece of physical evidence that they said connected him to the crime. When the gun was found, it was just this really hokey kind of rigged up gun. It had this flashlight taped to it, black duct tape, and then it had this green cord. You know that very common nylon green cord almost all of us have, like laying around the house? You can get any Walmart, even dollar stores. It had a length of green cord, nylon cord attached to it. One of the witnesses who was Greg's friend, who was basically, I mean, years later, we know that he was kind of pressured and forced into it, said that he remembered that cord being in Greg's yard and then it disappeared. And Greg was like, yeah, because I cleaned it up. I mean, they had attacked fireworks on the cord on the 4th of July. And so the state was like, oh, he used that cord to tie to the gun. And so that's, but they didn't find his fingerprints on it. And this is again, 2000 by the time he's arrested. Zero DNA testing is done on any of this. They found two fingerprints on the batteries and the flashlight didn't match him. And the way they operated is they didn't try to match it to anybody else.
Did the police were there any within the investigative file, were there any leads that the police were ignoring because they had the tunnel vision on, or did they not even look anywhere else?
Well, here's the thing. The file didn't reflect any leads other than like one officer who that night around the same time as the fire said that he had seen a truck in the area with a couple of guys and it looked suspicious. That went nowhere. It wasn't until years later, actually, really until the podcast aired and a new witness, not new, we've known and the family has known that he probably knows something, but he didn't talk until last year, basically told us that he had been there the night of the murder. He had been across the street at the night of the murder, the Horns residence. And he knew exactly what happened. He knew who killed the victims. And he said that he himself had gone to the TBI agent, that's the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation agent, and said, I don't know what you're doing investigating this guy, Greg, but you know the Horns are responsible. I know. And that the agent said to him, shut up. Just shut up about this. Nobody's going to believe you. And we already got our guy, and I just need you to shut up. So what happened was, over the course of all these years, when Greg was locked up, he ended up getting locked up with people who were related to the Horns or knew the Horns and actually knew through the grapevine or because they were there that night. The Horns ran a meth house. So there were people in and out like all night. There were at least four or five other people there that night. And so there was another witness that Greg was incarcerated with who just felt terrible about the whole thing. And he was like, you know, in our interview with him, he was like, Greg's like a church boy. He's like, I can't believe that he's been locked up in here all this time. And Greg's wife was pregnant when he got locked up. And so he missed the birth of his baby. He's never seen her outside of prison, Rebecca. She's a beautiful young woman now. And so this guy also, his name's Billy Cleghorn, was like, I mean, I know it wasn't Greg. I know it was the Horns. I was there that night. And that gun, Sam owned a gun like that. There were multiple witnesses who have said that not only do they know Sam owned that gun, they had shot the gun. They had fired the gun themselves in his house. So, yeah, I mean, our main suspects are the Horns. We know it's the Horns. I mean, like, there's just no two ways about it. And this witness who was there across the street that night, who said that he had told the TBI and told police and they told him to shut up. In the very final episode, we have his audio, which is kind of shocking, the things that he finally admits to. And after the podcast stopped airing, he continued to talk.
Are you going to be returning to the case with the new information?
I've never left the case in terms of like kind of still working with the legal team. When Greg came to us, he had not been legally represented in many, many years. I mean, it was heartbreaking. He had filed pro se petitions, meaning like he's representing himself and writing hundreds of pages even by hand. And he just didn't have a lawyer. He couldn't afford one for many years. So thanks to the podcast and then connecting with other lawyers in In Tennessee, we were able to put together an incredible legal team that we have working on this case. We're not publicly sharing who that team is right now because they want to work quietly behind the scenes right now, but it's a tremendous team and they're getting ready. You know, they're getting ready to make some moves on a legal front in the case. And so let's see how that goes.
So as this case stands right now, there's nothing pending, but they're preparing to.
Right.
Are they going to be filing a petition for exoneration for actual innocence?
So Tennessee's tough. I think they're going to be looking the fact there is the fact as I don't know if an evidence review has been done. The part of the problem is the evidence was really mishandled over the years. The gun, the flashlight, all these things. I mean, now that, you know, you remember we've talked about like how incredible touch DNA is and the vacuum mm-hmm. methodology. We can extract so much evidence now. The problem is there were times when Greg's mother went to the courthouse and was like, can I look at the evidence? Can I look? And they just gave it to her and she's like touching the gun, you know? So the evidence has not been handled properly over the years. And this is a factor. Having said that, those two fingerprints are still outstanding. And there's a whole world of DNA evidence that maybe exists that we have not been able to. So I believe that that's one aspect that the lawyers are going to look at is how best in Tennessee to get agreement on testing the DNA with the DA's office. And just what the best, I mean, they have a different post-conviction procedure than they do in Maryland, so I'm not that familiar with it, but they're still kind of trying to explore. You know how it is, like in a case, it's like, we've got all these different issues, what's our best foot forward type of thing? So they're still trying to prioritize that.
Right. There's always this balance of what you know and what you can prove yeah. in court and what you're allowed to prove in court.
And the other crazy thing is, like in many of the cases like this, like even a witness who's testified, if they recant, and by the way, in Greg's case, a number of the witnesses recanted. They recanted afterwards. But we've seen this in multiple cases that when witnesses recant, courts will say, well, that's not enough. Like you either lied then or you're lying now, right? So like you're not right. credible. And so that's not enough to overturn the conviction or grant a new trial. So you have to have that coupled with something a little stronger oftentimes.
Right. Are you confident that you'll have that in Greg's case?
I'm pretty confident about it. I think it's just a matter of, I mean, I say that, but then it's like, gosh, like, man, you just can't, there are judges and prosecutors, like you just don't know. The right thing to do in this case would really be and we have been told that there are people in the DA's office that have listened to the series. It's a whole new legal team there, you know? So it's not like it's the same players from 20 odd years ago. It's different people. And I've heard a lot of great things about this district attorney, that he's very fair. And so I really hope that maybe what would happen is that once the legal team gets to a point where they need to start talking to the DA about what they're going to do moving forward, that the DA himself would be like, you know what? I'm not going to oppose any of this and I'm going to join you guys in trying to figure this out. Further, maybe we got the wrong person.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
We've had that in a couple of cases where we got conviction integrity units involved. And right. it makes the process much, much, much more.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say
I don't
simple,
think
but
this
easier.
County has its own conviction. I'm not quite sure. I don't think it does actually, but not everybody has a conviction integrity. This is the problem.
Right.
So they might not. But having said that, again, I've heard good things about this DA. And so I think in fairness, if we're able to present the statements of this witness who now is saying, I was there that night and I saw all these different things. And again, all the witnesses connected to the Horns don't know Greg. They've never known Greg. Like their mm-hmm. worlds were not, never crossed paths. Greg's never did drugs. Like it was just completely different world. So they have no reason to be lying about this. Not just one, but multiple witnesses, like four or five different ones saying that, oh, we know it was the Horns.
Right. Is there anywhere where, are there fundraisers for legal funds or petitions or anywhere where our listeners can go to try and help?
Right now, there aren't any fundraisers or petitions for him because there hasn't been any movement legally. And on the fundraising aspect, thankfully, the legal team working for him is doing it pro bono. However, Greg makes he's an incredible craftsman. If he gets out, I was like, you're going to build me a house, like a dream house, I'll pay you for it. He's a beautiful craftsman and he makes these beautiful, it's a gift to me and Susan and Colin. He made these beautiful little log cabin homes. I can't even describe it, out of like tightly rolled newspaper as little logs. And he dyed it with coffee and then they're incredible. And so I think just to help raise money, like for his daughter, because he hasn't been able to provide for her. And, you know, she's at that age, 19, 20, you know, I've seen these little hands. That we're going to try to put those on Etsy or sell them somewhere. And so when I do that, when that's all set up, I'll let you know, Bob, and maybe you can share it with your listeners.
That would be awesome. And for more information on this case, you can go check it out on Undisclosed. What season number was Greg's case?
This is like season 4. But really, if you go to our website, I mean, it's hard to keep track because we go back and forth. We do updates. But if you go to our website and you just look at basically past cases, you'll find the State versus Greg Lance. And that was season 4. It was from last fall, like from a year ago. We're about to. So right now, Colin is in the middle of a couple of his short series. We're going to do like 2 short series. And then Susan begins her long fall series in October, late October.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm actually, I'm going to have Colin on, I believe, next week. He's coming on to talk about the series that he's doing right now.
Brookins. Yeah, it's a great case.
And I've been talking to Susan. We're trying to work something out to talk about one of her cases, too. So all of that, listeners will be up and coming. Mm. But I will get destroyed by my audience if while I have you on the phone, I don't ask you for an update on Adnan's case. How is he doing? Where is he at? Are we still kind of in a holding pattern?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, last year after winning 2 appeals, we lost the final appeal in the court, in the highest court of Maryland by 1 vote, a panel of 7 judges. And it was really devastating. It took him, I think, 4 or 5 months to kind of get out of his trauma over it. It took me the same time. I truly was traumatized. I think the whole legal team was. Nobody expected it after all these years. And to lose by 1 vote is really hard to accept. So we basically just had to take a step back and say, okay, now what? Are we going to go to a federal habeas? Are we going to get back in post-conviction court? What is the best? So I ended up by the end of the year pulling together this great kind of brain trust of lawyers to really think it through. And we basically have a kind of an expanded legal team. We have a new lead counsel on the case, a new investigator who has never worked on the case with us directly before. And they've been working really, really hard this entire year. And they're kind of doing what's going on in Greg's case, which is trying to figure out what's, you know, lining up all the ducks, getting everything in a row. Hopefully for Adnan, we will be back in court sometime by the end of the year with a filing. And I'm not going to reveal who these folks are working on the case because you don't want to give the states a heads up ever. But
right.
They're a fantastic team, very, very committed, like literally just working on this case day and night. It's like the only work they're doing. So we're not giving up. It's as simple as that. For Adnan, we always have, we do have 2 ways if you want to donate, because it's not a pro bono team. We do have to pay legal bills every month and investigator bills. So there's a launch good, which is you can give as much money as you want, one time or however. And that's launchgood.com/freeadnan. Or you can be a Patreon supporter, which is like you can give $1 a month or $5 a month or whatever. And then on the Patreon, it's patreon.com/freeadnan. I just do like updates, or actually this week we had a conversation with Adnan that I posted. And so it'll just be different things on there.
Well, that's awesome. And how is Adnan doing? Is he kind of regrouped?
He's doing
after?
Better. Yeah, no, he's doing much better. I'll tell you, you know, the first time I saw him after the appellate loss last year, I wasn't able to see him for about 6 weeks. And I think in that matter of time, he had lost like 40 pounds and his beard had gone gray. I mean, because he was in such shock. We were really just preparing for him to come home. But thankfully, he's good now. He's gotten much better. He knows people are still working on the case. He knows nobody's walking away. And he's gained back his weight. he's doing good. He's doing well.
Well, that's good to know. Well, please let him know that we send our love and prayers for me and my audience. And
I will.
And he's definitely not forgotten about.
Yeah, no, I definitely will, because he's the one that everybody asked me about. Once in a while, he wonders, you know, I don't think people care about this. I'm like, you don't understand. So many people care about this case every day.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let him know that we're thinking about him, and also keep us posted on Greg's case. I'm really excited to see where that turns out through the end of the year as the legal team gets working on it.
Yeah. Same here. I'll definitely keep you guys updated. Thank you so much, Bob, for having me and for allowing me to talk about Greg's. I get invited to talk about Adnan's case a lot, but I'm really happy to talk about other cases too, because all of these cases need attention, as you know.
Well, anytime you have a case you want to talk about, you just let me know.
I will let you know. All right. Thanks so much.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show is created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of createdintandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, truthandjusticepod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kay Woodyomnik, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, and Jen Reese in Candela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that always include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. And I personally can be found on social media at Bob Ruff Truth, and Mike can be found at Murb Gaming. MURRBGAMING. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.
The Ford Ranger, a vehicle for all terrains and every passion. It's a workmate, a playmate, and to its drivers, a soulmate. So how do you improve the Ford Ranger? You go all in. The all-new Ford Ranger, the UK's best-selling pickup. Now available with rear bumper steps, tailgate workbench, and enlarged load box that can fit a Euro pallet. Go break it in. Search all-new Ford Ranger. Ford Pro. Driving productivity. According to SMMT data, features may be optional extras with additional cost.